Okay, so we are a small select group this morning. We are the cream of the cream, and we are here because we appreciate history, the arts, the wisdom of those in this room, and especially those two at the head table. There will be people who will be sad that they're not here, and I will bet actually that what has happened is that many of the attendees of this show are so old they went home already. So this is again why we are the few and you are the exclusive folks. I think probably everybody in this room is aware that Dick and Pat Lupoff, in one way or another, whether through their costumes at PitCon in 1960 or through Zero or through networking, they were networking before anybody said networking, spread the word of comics to the world at large and made everybody responsible. The few there are now responsible for what we have here. And by the way, as people gripe about pop culture and the fact that there are movies here and TV here and whatever here, they were always aware of that too. Dick and Pat, what were you guys doing before you did Zero?
Before I did Zero, I was in school, and I had gone to Connecticut College in Connecticut, New York. I was from Connecticut, the state. I was from New York, and I had taken a course that everybody told me not to take in physics chemistry. They said, take one, take the other. Oh, God, don't take both. Everybody flunks out. Well, guess what? I didn't get an F. I got a D, but I had to take another course to raise my grades. So somehow I ended up in Northwestern. Why Northwestern? I don't know. I loved it. And I had a roommate, and she wanted to know if I was going steady. I said yes, but I told this guy that I would be dating while I was away, and that was what he was going to date while I was away. And so to make a long story short, here was Dick, and here was this other guy that I was supposed to date, and we didn't know where they were from. We thought they lived right nearby Northwestern, and we went downstairs, and my girlfriend said, oh, that one, the shorter one. Oh, please, I used to go out with him. Oh, he's supposed to be your date, but can I didn't know either. And I saw this tall, great-looking guy here, you know, and standing there. And I said, oh, that's okay. I don't mind. So we went out for our first date and dinner, and we danced. And I thought that Dick was so sweet because somebody had told me that this guy, who ended up being a lieutenant in the Army, somebody had told me that he thought people had to dance. And I thought, well, he's stepping on my feet, but you know, it's so sweet of him. That's another thing. So he kept coming up every week, and finally my roommate said, he must really be in love with you. And I was sort of in love with him, and I said, why? Why, Ruth? Why do you think that? Well, he's coming, where were you? From Indianapolis. That's like, how many miles away?
196.
He's coming every week, for goodness sakes. So we are in love. We go home. We're going to meet again. And I have been dating this guy that my parents weren't too keen on. But as I got off the plane, they said, you can marry so-and-so. It's all right. Whatever you want. I said, no. No, no, no. No, I've met somebody new. And there is Richard, and he came into my life. And that's what I was doing.
Oh.
So I was the beneficiary of reverse wife swapping before anybody had heard of such an institution. Before Zero, essentially, I was in the Army. Got out and started a career as going to be a brilliant millionaire businessman, got into the computer industry at a very early stage, 1958. But I found the corporate world, pretty boring. And I'd always been something of a science fiction fan. I'd published my first fanzine in 1952. And
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
Things I don't know.
It was half size. I didn't have access to any kind of duplicating equipment, but I had a little Smith Corona portable typewriter. And by making multiple sandwiches of paper and carbon paper, and by whacking away at the keys really hard, I could make four copies at a time. Mm-hmm. So I typed each issue of the fanzine twice, giving me a grand total circulation of 8. And I was hooked. Once you start publishing, it's very hard to stop.
Yes.
So anyway, that was while I was in high school, college, army, marriage, corporate career, boredom with corporate career, back to fandom and back to publishing.
Don't forget about the hippie thing, because you kind of went
from... That came later.
Oh, okay. I'm just saying. We had seen Dick and Pat. They had been kind enough to give us sleeping space first in their New York City apartment and later in their Poughkeepsie apartment, all with simultaneous selfish urges on our part, one to troll through all the comic book publishers in the early 60s and then to visit Western Printing and Lithographing, which was in Poughkeepsie, which is where they were. And it was always, there's a photo in the souvenir booklet of us in their Poughkeepsie home. And it was just wonderful, so beautiful. And the next time we saw them, they were on a cross-country trip with the hair long and the tie-dye and the whatever. And went from corporate executive land to a later development.
Opposite.
Take us along that trip.
Well, again, I guess I'm just blessed or cursed with a short attention span. And I got bored. We were living in effect, a double life. As part of the New York science fiction borderline political, radical, intellectual art community. And at the same time, Monday through Friday, I'm putting on my suit and tie and going to work for the International Business Machines Corporation. The result of this is something that is, I think, called cognitive dissonance. And I became extremely dissonant. But we got over that, too.
Well, I remember the apartment you were in New York. You had a dog named Snoopy,
yes.
Which how famished Ken one got. And that this was the dog that, whenever anyone came to the door, would immediately go berserk.
Yes.
But you had a closet. And so you would throw the dog in the closet when it was not the door.
Would we throw the dog in the closet?
Maggie has a good memory.
I'm just saying. And after you guys left, the neighbors complained about the dog, but after you left the building, there were how many robberies on that same floor? Because when the elevator doors would open, Snoopy would,
yes.
You know. And you had one of your film club meetings for our benefit at your house, and we saw, because that was the thing, is nobody had VCRs or home whatevers. And Chris Steinbrenner came over and I believe ran Bride of Frankenstein, which I'd never seen. But you also had an anecdote about when the Binders, you told a portion of that anecdote about watching with Otto and his wife, watching the adventures of Captain Marvel.
Yes, well, Otto Binder, or as I thought of him as a kid, Yando Binder, because I didn't have any idea how to pronounce that odd name. Of course, does everyone here know why Yando Binder was called Yando, E-A-N-D-O?
No,
well, it was originally a collaboration by two brothers, the Binder brothers, Earl and Otto, E and O. And they just created a portmanteau named Ian O.
And they had the text pieces in all the all the Fawcett comics,
yes.
With John Jarl, as you brought back to my brain.
And, of course, Otto was the main writer on Captain Marvel. For its entire, well, he didn't. He was not the very first writer, but he took over very early on and ran Captain Marvel for most of its entire 13-year run. And then when Fawcett went out of business, he went over and wrote Superman. But I think Captain Marvel was always the one in his heart. It was always the one in my heart, as you might infer. At any rate, when we started publishing Zero and published the first installment of All in Color for a Dime, which was called The Big Red Cheese, was about Captain Marvel and the Marvel family. I took a copy of the fanzine up to the offices of Space World magazine, which was where Otto was editing in those days. It was published by a very small company, and I walked in, again, in my corporate executive suit, carrying a manila envelope with a fanzine in it, and this very pleasant woman met me at the door, and I said, I brought this for Mr. Binder, as I called him. And she says, oh, well, just a minute, you know, I'll get him out of the inner office and you can hand it to him. I was so terrified of this towering godlike figure who had written hundreds of pulp magazine stories and thousands of comic book stories and to me was an absolute Olympian titan. I was terrified. I said, no, don't, here. And I practically shoved the envelope into this woman's hands and said, just give it to him. And I ran out because I thought, otherwise he'll want to shake hands with me and I'll faint. So I left. Shortly thereafter, though, we had a very lovely letter from Otto thanking us for Zero, thanking us for the article about Captain Marvel and the nice things we'd said about him, and pointing out a few of the errors in it, which led to a correspondence and then to a personal friendship. We visited the Binders at their home in New Jersey, and Otto gave us a tour of his collected works, which was just wonderful. And then, as Maggie mentioned, we were members of a little film society. In that era, she says nobody had a VCR. Why not? There was no such thing as a VCR. That's why not. So once a movie came and went, it was just gone, unless you find it in some obscure little art repertory theater located underneath the subway tracks. Chris Steinbrenner, though, a local fan, a borderline fan, was the film library manager for a television station in New York. He had access to their whole film library. And through his networking with his professional associates at the other stations, you know, I work for Channel 9, you work for Channel 4, we've got a copy of Jungle Girl, Neoka the Jungle Girl, all 12 chapters. What do you have? And I'll swap. That's the way it works. So Chris could get all sorts of wonderful films. He had a projector, and he started a society. On a typical Sunday afternoon, he would set up maybe an Agatha Christie program. We'd watch two features in the afternoon, take a dinner break, and watch a third Agatha Christie, and then everyone would go home. The next Sunday, he might do a Boris Karloff show. The next Sunday, maybe a Basil Rathbone show. And about once a month or so, he'd vary these by doing a serial. One of which, a brilliant, brilliant serial with Roy Barkaroff called The Purple Monster Strikes. Anyone here ever seen that? You have. You remember why he was called The Purple Monster? It's explained in the dialogue.
Okay, then I'm going to leave it here.
Earthman greets this alien spaceship, out jumps Roy Barkaroff, who was mainly a Western actor, but he was doing a spaceman, an alien spaceman in this. And the Earthman says something to the effect of hello, my name is James McPherson, what's your name? And Roy Barkaroff says, my name is in an alien tongue which you could never pronounce, so just call me the Purple Monster. Those things were... They were, well, I guess inspired idiocy would be the term for them. On another Sunday, Chris told us, I've got The Adventures of Captain Marvel, the whole series, Tom Tyler as the superhero, Nigel de Broglie as the ancient Egyptian wizard, except for some reason they made him an ancient Siamese wizard, but who's counting? The whole rest of the cast, it was quite a good serial.
David Sharp stunting amazingly. Just thought I'd mention it. He's my favorite stunt man. And every time, I understand Tom Tyler would knock over a chair when he came into the room, but Sharp, when they said, Superman, you will believe a man can fly, well, I believed it, when Sharp would just leap off a cliff. I mean, he did, so just say.
Was he a stunt double?
Yeah, Dave Sharp was the stunt double for Tyler.
The flying, and if you ever have a chance to see that serial, considering that it was made around 1940, the flying is excellent. You know, our little six-year-old grandson was over the house recently, and he wanted to see an old Superman TV episode from the 60s on the computer, and we managed to pull it up. And he says, "Now watch, that's the actor, but when he jumps out the window, he turns into a cartoon, and he flies as a cartoon, and then he lands and turns back into an actor," which is pretty perceptive for a six-year-old. But in the Captain Marvel serial, he really flew. And he, at any rate, this is a little bit off topic. We're arranged with our friend Chris to have a meeting of the Fantasy Film Club at our apartment, going to watch The Adventures of Captain Marvel. We invite the Binders, and the three of them arrive, Otto and his wife Ione, and their daughter Mary. I went into the other room and brought out our little boy. Our first child had just been born. I knew the Binders were coming, so I got a set of the smallest size I could get of bright red men's briefs, cut out a little yellow lightning bolt and stitched it on there, and put it on him over his diaper. So when the Binders arrived, I come out of the other room with this few months old baby and say, "Here he is, this is Captain Marvel baby." And Otto and Mary and Ione, they just loved it. And they just loved the serial because none of them had ever seen it.
And the quote that you told us years ago was at the conclusion that Mrs. Binder was constantly saying, "Say the word, Billy, say the word."
Yes. Well, in order, the inspired idiocy of serial writers was, everything is going wrong, you know, gangsters with machine guns and crashing automobiles and bombers dropping high explosives on them. And Billy Batson is standing around saying, played by Frank Coughlin Jr.,
whom I met and got to autograph my laser disc.
Wow.
Yeah. Very exciting.
You. Anyway, Billy is sitting there turning to whatever friend is nearby. A young lady that he was friends with, and so they made him a little older. He was sort of like 18-ish in the film. He was more like 12, I thought, in the comics. But yes, and he's saying, "Oh my God, the bombers are dropping high explosives, and those gangsters with the machine guns are thrumming through the doorway, and this 18-wheeler truck is about to crash through the wall. What should we do? What should we do?" And Ione Binder is saying, "Say the word, Billy. Say the word, Billy." Finally, he caught on and said the word and turned into Captain Marvel. But it was still great fun. I really enjoyed that.
The other quote you conveyed to us at the time was that Otto said, "I made Billy dumb, but I didn't make him that dumb."
That's true. That's true.
Pat, what was the challenge of, I mean, here you are, you're home, you're raising kids, you blah, 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 and publishing. I mean, you're getting the letters in, you're getting the sticky quarters in, how do you coordinate all that stuff while he's off at the office doing executive things?
Well, if I hadn't been doing that, I would have had to go out and get a job. This way, I could stay home, I could walk my dog, I could take a nap, and my little child took a nap, and I could also work at something I love working. So it was busy stuff. But it wasn't like a 9-to-5 job. I could stop. I could get a cup of coffee whenever I wanted to. And I loved doing it. I loved reading people's letters and responding to people's letters. I loved handling all the little money. I sort of wish there was, you know, bigger bills. They would be easier. They wouldn't fall through my purse and fall on the sidewalk when I walked to get them. And I also, for some reason, that Dick will tell you, because I get confused at this, he was afraid by putting all the zeros in just walking to the post office, which I could easily have done. I should go around somehow and put them all in different mailboxes, because otherwise he was afraid the government would interfere. And I'm not sure. You told me this, but tell me again.
That's essentially it. I'm just not good with bureaucracy. And I thought, if we go down to the post office and I need to talk to a postmaster and get a third-class mailing permit or whatever it has to do, it just absolutely, the whole notion of it repelled me. So instead, we just put the fanzines, which eventually had a circulation of 300, which was, believe it or not, big if you have to turn a mimeograph crank that many times, and it's a 100-page magazine, and a lot of it is in 2 and 3 colors, so the sheets have to go through repeated times, you develop a pretty strong arm. Anyway, 300 copies of a 100-page fanzine is a very, very substantial job. And I just couldn't see dealing with the bureaucracy of the post office. So I didn't know how to do this, except that Pat or I would go out in the evening. The other one would have to stay home with the baby. And take a suitcase full of fanzines and go down. We had put stamps on them, of course. Go down to the corner mailbox and drop in a dozen copies. And then walk a block to another mailbox and drop another dozen copies in there. Until we had blanketed the neighborhood. And we'd get about 100 copies out that way. And then the next night we would repeat it, and the third night we would repeat it. And the local post office, they never got in touch with us. I lived in terror of a doorbell ringing, and it's not the FBI, it's the postal inspectors wanting to know, what are you doing, citizen? But it never happened.
And also, as you say, the issues kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yes,
and then even collating the copies. Did you have collation? I mean, did your friends get together and help?
Yes, we did, including Don and Elsie Walheim. And Don, when he got bored, would go around to our library and autograph them. Like, remember you found...
He autographed. We have a copy of the complete Sherlock Holmes, personally autographed. It says Arthur Conan Doyle. It was actually written by Donald Walheim. Talk about a unique copy.
That is wonderful. Don Walheim was a major publisher, but Daw Books was Donald A. Walheim. And so the fact that the Walheims were there helping you collate and staple.
Well, we were very good friends with them, and we loved their little daughter, Betsy. And we just had a good time with them. Elsie would sort of go around the table and think of other things and sit down, and Don would say, "Elsie, we're not through yet." And I'd say, "It's okay, Elsie. It's all right."
Well, Elsie was a lovely woman, but she was really the way Gracie Allen pretended to be. And we would have a collating party. There would be maybe 6 or 8 people. Artist named Larry Ivey used to come. Bob Stewart, who was our art director and designer, would come. Charles Brown, who later went on to be Mr. Locus, was part of that group. And Don and Elsie would come. And we'd make a big pot of spaghetti and say, as soon as we finish collating, that's the only way we can clear the dining room table, then we can all have dinner. Elsie used to say, and the way it worked, of course, you just circle the table, one after another, picking up a copy of page 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, you put them all together, the person at the end of the line slams it with a stapler, and you have a magazine. Elsie Walheim said, "I can't get this right. I know I'm going to do it wrong. I know I'm going to do it wrong." I said, "Oh, Elsie, don't worry, don't worry. I'm sure you can do it right." Well, if there were 8 people collating and we would get to the end of it, end of the process, I would then, before slamming with the stapler, I would go through the stack of collated pages, and every 8th set was completely screwed up. I said, Elsie Walheim strikes again. But she was a total sweet, totally, totally sweet woman. I always adored her.
Excuse me, this is going to be a question to Dick. Didn't we go to Noreen and Larry's place in Staten Island to do some collating, or what did we do there?
No, the mimeograph was there.
We didn't have a mimeo at that point.
We lived in a Manhattan apartment.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I did not realize that.
You talk about neighbors complaining about our dog. Can you imagine hours and hours long into the night of a mimeograph, in a Manhattan apartment house? No. But Larry and Noreen, Larry was the editor at Lancer Books at the time. And he and his wife, Noreen, who was a librarian, were longtime science fiction fans and very good friends of ours. And they had a mimeograph in their basement. So what we would do typically when we had all the stencils ready to do another issue of Zero. Which of course, we cut stencils at home, and that's no problem. You can operate a typewriter or a mimeoscope. But when we were ready to do the actual mimeography, we would borrow Pat's parents' car because we didn't have one, and we would drive out to Staten Island. We'd drive the car down to the base of Manhattan
with Snoopy,
with our dog, and drive onto the ferry, right out to Staten Island, drive to Larry and Noreen's house, and go down in the basement and run the mimeograph hour after hour after hour.
I had no idea. I mean, we always just thought you had your little... I mean, it's true that when we visited you, there was no publishing empire in the
Wow. So, yeah, and then we would go home with these huge corrugated boxes full of 300 copies of page one, 300 copies of page three, and so forth. But as the magazine progressed, which in a way was a good thing, but in another way it led to the demise of Zero, was it was getting so big and so elaborate that we were going to offset printers, draw printers, and getting them to print up special inserts for us. It was always mimeographed to the very end, but we had printed covers, we had printed inserts. A brilliant cartoonist named Landon Chesney did a multi-page...
Two Flashes Meet the Purple Slag Heap.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. It was the first crossover between the Golden Age Flash and the New Era Flash. And it was just hilarious. His favorite his expression, I believe, was the Flash would see something that amazed him, and he would say, "Viola!" Because clearly, Landon Chesney didn't know how to spell voila. Or maybe he did, and this was on purpose. I never knew. It was very funny. Another brilliant fan cartoonist did a long multi-page comic strip for us called Fandy, based on a short-lived newspaper comic strip called Dondi. Dondi was a little World War II war orphan who winds up as this big, wide-eyed adoptee in America. And he's never seen anything like America. It's quite a good comic strip. And one of our contributors did Fandy, which was the fanish version. We had another... There were two fans in that era named Norman Clark. One was a professional musician who lived near Toronto, but the other was a New York fan and a contributor to Zero. He was something of a theater historian. And he was researching legitimate theaters in New York, and there was a huge classic theater in New York called the Hippodrome. And he researched the Hippodrome and discovered that at one time they had put on a huge stage production, maybe the largest single stage drama in modern theater history. It was called A Yankee Circus on Mars. And it was literally about this, I mean, this was circa 1888, right? It's about this interplanetary traveling circus that goes to Mars and puts on a performance before the royal court of the Emperor and Empress of Mars. And they had elephants in the show, and they had chariots in the show, and they, of course, had to have a spaceship in the show. Norm Clark did a big article built around this. Title of it, anybody want to guess, or anybody remember what it was? The Greatest Shows Unearthly. And he found some actual production photos of the Yankee Circus in Mars. Well, this was too good to resist. So Norm got us a good glossy photo of one of these. And I took it down to a job printer and I said, "What can you do with this?" And he said, "Oh, I can work with this." And we got a what would be double times 8.5 by 11, 11 by 17, double width gatefold printout of this 1880s photo of a Yankee circus on Mars, and stapled that into every copy of Zero. And we did all sorts of stuff like that.
You have to understand that the contributors to Zero were not, quote, just comic fans, or not, quote, just science fiction fans. It was a behind-the-scenes, historical, pop culture. I mean, you had mystery writers talking about how they marketed their mystery things. Your letters columns were professionals discussing the market and the process of writing and who their favorites were and so forth. I mean, this was probably the most informative popular culture amateur magazine. I can't say if it's maybe the first. I don't know.
And it was an accident. We had no such intention. We were not out to create anything or to change the world or to start a revolution. We were newlyweds. We were both very young, and we were having fun. That's all that it was. But you mentioned mystery writers. Donald Westlake, at that time, was very early in his career and was writing science fiction and was writing mysteries. And he decided to quit writing science fiction and concentrate on mysteries. And he wrote a little... Well, the way we met him, I'll have to back up a little. Chris Steinbrenner, the Fantasy Film Club man, threw a cocktail party one week. And Pat and I are at the party, and this great big man, I don't know if anybody here ever knew Don Westlake, he was a giant, comes over, and hand on shoulder, and he says, "Hey, kid, heard you publish a fanzine." I said, "Yes." He says, "You want an essay for your fanzine?" I said, "Sure. Let me see the manuscript. If it's any good, you know, maybe we can use it." And he says, "All right, give me your address." And a couple of days later, we get an envelope in the mail, and out pops a little personal essay called "Don't Call Me, I'll Call You." It's addressed to all the science fiction editors that he had ever worked with, starting with John W. Campbell, Horace L. Gold, Seal Goldsmith, whoever were the other editors of the day. And he tells off each one of them very, very accurately. "Why, you're an idiot, you're a thug, you're in the wrong profession, and I'm never going to work for any of you again." So we accepted it for our fanzine. Okay. Some weeks go by, the fanzine, that issue is all done, and we're home on a Sunday afternoon, and the phone rings, and it's Don Westlake's literary agent. And he says, "I've heard about this essay that Don wrote for your fanzine." I said, "Yes." He says, You can't publish that. I said, "Why not?" He says, "Well, look, he's ruining himself with all of the markets. Please, don't publish it. What can I do? What can I give you to replace it? So you won't suffer in any way, but you must not publish this." I said, "Sir, there's nothing I can do. 300 copies have already been distributed among our 15 closest mailboxes. And they're going to start hitting people's inboxes tomorrow morning." So his agent says, "Oh my God, Westlake has killed himself." End of conversation. Well, all he did was go on to, you know, win an Oscar for best screenplay and become one of the best-selling and most popular and talented mystery writers in the world. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, he died very suddenly. And a publisher in San Francisco had asked us if they could do a book called The Best of Zero. And we'd agreed to do it. And then I had to get back in touch with all of the contributing writers and ask, "Would you mind if I use it?" And I had to get in touch with Abby Westlake, Don's widow, and she said, "Oh, of course, go ahead and use it. And I said, "Listen, we haven't been in touch since his death, you know. Sorry that we didn't contact you to express our sympathy." And she says, "It's all right." I said, "But I had to identify myself." I said, "And, you know, I'm the fanzine editor who published Don't Call Me, I'll Call You." And she says, "At the memorial service after Don's death, Lawrence Block read that essay in lieu of a eulogy."
As time goes, seriously, as time goes on, I realize time has gone on. And if there are questions from the floor, I'm rudely up here asking questions I want answered. Is there anyone out there with a question? And do speak loudly because you're not mic'd.
No problem. In terms of talking about pop culture, I mean, there's a lot of literary stuff that you're talking about, and obviously I haven't read any of these things, and I wasn't around in the 50s and very early 60s, but I wasn't reading until the 70s. cover film? Did you cover television at the time? You know, some of the early films, some of the early, you know, Tales of Tomorrow, those really early TV shows that we don't hear about at all anymore. Were people talking about those? Were they covered?
And I'll just repeat it for the recorders, which is, did you cover such pop culture as films and television at that time, as well as
In the first issue of Zero, being Neo fans in a sense, we didn't have many contacts, so we mainly wrote the whole first issue ourselves. But one other fan in New York heard that we were working on a fanzine, and he contacted us and said, "Can I contribute a movie review to your first issue?" And we said, "Sure, send us the usual, send us a manuscript, and if it's any good." It was a review of Psycho, the film, which had just been released, and the reviewer was Harlan Ellison. A couple issues later, we had an article bylined Arthur Merlin. Arthur Merlin was a pseudonym of James Blish, and James Blish had been called in as a sometimes script doctor and sometimes script writer for the original Captain Video television series. And he wrote a memoir of what it was like in that era to write science fiction for television. And then the third thing, as part of the All in Color for a Dime series, the same fellow we've mentioned several times, Chris Steinbrunner, who really knew films, did an essay called something about the Saturday evening four-color screen, which, of course, was not four-color. It was only black and white. But it was, I believe it was the first, at least slightly scholarly treatment of comic books and especially superhero adaptations into films. So he had a section on Adventure Captain Marvel, section on Superman versus Atom Man, section on Batman and Robin serial, all of this. So we didn't concentrate a whole lot on films and television, but there were at least those three items that do come to mind.
Thank you.
Comic books and science fiction bigger today than they were then? ?
Okay, first of all, I compliment you on your taste in shirts.
Yeah.
Brilliant shirt. Do you want to respond to that?
No, I don't.
Well, in my opinion, what we're seeing, okay, adventure stories, in a broad sense, are one of the oldest forms of culture. You go back, the Bible is full of, aside from theology and morality and so forth, it's full of adventure stories. Greek myths are full of adventure stories. Shinto myths are full of adventure stories. The Bhagavad Gita is full of adventure stories. People love adventure. They somehow address some deep human need. So people have always loved them, and I think they always will. The only thing that changes is the medium of presentation. So whether you're talking about what we think of, what we thought of as Golden Age comic books, 64 pages printed on newsprint with a glossy cover and so forth was the classic format. Today's comic books are very different, and some that I've seen downstairs in this convention center are just beautiful, brilliant productions. The circulation, the standard circulation, of course, of this month's issue of Superman is nowhere near what it was 40 years ago. But it doesn't matter, because Superman is as big or bigger than ever. Batman is probably the biggest pop culture figure that we have today. Some years ago it was somebody else. Some years in the future it will be somebody else. Whether we go from penny dreadfuls to dime novels to pulp magazines to comic books, paperback books, television shows, the medium keeps changing. Technology makes the medium change. But there's still stories of heroes, stories of beautiful, noble women, stories of horrible monsters, stories of the works.
Right.
That doesn't change, and I don't think that will ever change.
If I could just toss in one additional thing, is that the mass market metamorphosis has absolutely happened between when you were beginning zero and now. And I would call to your attention the Toronto World Science Fiction Convention, in which Bijou Trimble stood up, and at that point, it was, I believe, 2 years after Star Trek hit television. And she stood up at the convention, and the science fiction fans were all snooty-tooty about Star Trek. And she said, "You guys have been complaining for a decade that there aren't any women collecting science fiction." She said, "Look around you. The women are here because of Star Trek. And if you look out here, the comics conventions that were here 20 years ago were primarily male, primarily collecting superheroes. And if you look out on the floor, it's entire families reveling in storytelling." Yeah. And that, to me, is a major difference.
Oh, if I could please have a couple more minutes, I want to add to that. I've been thinking about this for some time now. The earliest comic conventions, and prior to that, the science fiction conventions that I knew as a young fan, and Pat as a young fan, in the 1960s, there were certain characteristics of the audience. What I jotted down, they were 90% male, 99% white, 100% heterosexual, or at least overtly so. I'm sure there were closeted fans, but they were deeply closeted. And 100% able-bodied. And now, I use the term includes everybody in this room and everybody in this building. We have learned some lessons, and we have become so inclusive that you just go around, walk around that floor downstairs, you see it's a multicultural, multi-ethnic, the gender balance is just about 50-50. You see disabled people, you see overtly gay people, and nobody cares, because we're all here to celebrate our mutual love for this art form and this medium. And we don't care about any of that other bullshit, because it was only bullshit anyway, and we're well rid of it.
We have 5 minutes left. Are there any other questions? In which...
Lately there's been some changes in the comic book industry. Recently they've been beginning to accept novelization forms of prose and poetry. How is it like for this new type of writing and to come into the comic book industry? How is that like?
How is it like the metamorphosis from the ordinary pamphlet into editions of prose, poetry, editions of other aspects of art into what we saw as comic books?
Well, one of the things I saw when I was growing up is that comic books also use things like Wuthering Heights as classic novels, a classic comic book. And I remember reading a lot of these when I was in bed sick with whatever I got sick with at school, which was always. And then going on to get the book, because I knew the comic book was great, and I loved to read the comic book, but it wasn't quite as detailed as the 500-page book I might wanted to read. And it turned me on to a lot of novels that I wouldn't have known, perhaps, that existed. And in that way, I think it was a good thing, but it did happen long ago. It hasn't just sprung out now. Now they call them graphic novels. I'm not sure of the difference at all. But it doesn't mean anything. I think comic books have always been around and have always been a pretty big seller.
Thank you.
And what have you done since then? I bet you guys have done stuff since then.
Well, we have our three kids. We have five grandkids. Five now.
So far.
We have four cats, three dogs, two tanks of fish, and I work for a fantasy bookstore that just opened up a comic book.
You can say what it is.
Well, Eclipse, and Hey, I forgot where I worked. No. Dark Carnival. Sorry. Dark Carnival was up a few blocks. I used to work at Cody's. I work at Dark Carnival now because Cody's been out of business. And boy, I don't feel like I'm working at all. I'm just having fun, taking the books off the floor and putting them back on the shelf or whatever.
And Dick?
Well, for a lot of years, I wrote books, a fair number. In recent years, I've been running a publishing company, sort of, fulfilling a childhood ambition. You know that poem that says, little fleas have littler fleas to bite them and to bother, or something, bother and to bite them, and so on ad infinitum. Well, there's a little publishing company called Ramble House, and that's about the size of a flea. And it has a subsidiary called Suriname Turtle Press, named for a creature whose ugliness is exceeded only by its laziness. And I'm running Suriname Turtle Press, having a great time being an editor and publisher, but I'm not earning a living at it, or even remotely so, and I'm going to have to get back and start writing books again soon.
And there are many books to write, for us to read that you have written, and can we find information about that on, say, Wikipedia or a website or something?
I have a website, but I'm such a total techno nerd, I don't even know how to access it to add any information. There must be a way. But there is a... Somebody put up a Wikipedia page for me. Has a picture of me taken in 1957 when I was in the Army. And it's reasonably complete and reasonably accurate.
Excellent. I've been told we have time for one more question if anyone has one. Then I will ask one more question. What are you going to do in the next year that we can all look forward to?
Clean our house.
Yeah.
Love
clean
it.
Our house.